Warning, the hosts of this program are not broadcast professionals. They have no idea what they're doing. They are bad at this. One of them uses swear words. A lot. All complaints about this show are correct. You have been warned. This is your last chance to download a real podcast. Okay, you asked for it. Here are Dave Brown and Iron Mike Irons. This is Entitled Town.
All right. Thank you, Al. Glad to have Al here with us. I'm surprised he wanted to come back after our catastrophic draft episode, but we're back, and Al's with us, and Iron Mike Irons is with us, and I'm Dave Brown, and this is Entitled Town, and we are moving on from the draft into this unknown territory between what should be off-season training activities and coming up this month, and then heading into what should be the preseason in July, and a lot of uncertainty right now. The things that we do know, like I said, Iron Mike Irons is here. Mike, we tried to do a Zoom that was supposed to be broadcast live on Facebook. That was, especially in the beginning, a disaster because people were Zoom bombing us, which is what they call it, when people put offensive things on the screen, and there were racial slurs, and there were just nasty, nasty graphic images, and that was step one that we had to deal with, and then it turned into like a 3.5 hour, almost 4 hour broadcast. And
it was an automobile accident in slow motion, which initially began with a Mike Loiko job interview. Is that racist?
And I apologize to anyone who tried to find us on Facebook and couldn't. We had trouble working that out. And then
blame it Zuckerberg. Don't blame us.
It turned into a nice conversation among a dozen or so people towards the end. But and then the Patriots actually didn't even make a draft in the draft pick in the first round. So. Anyway, a lot was learned, more than we bargained for, certainly. But I do apologize if you were trying to find us and you couldn't. But now we're here with a regular episode, back to our bread and butter, and I'm very excited. We had a draft recently, and I know Al was hoping for weapons. What did you think of the draft? Taking Duggar after they traded down with their first pick, and then trading back in the second round to get Uche, and also picked up a good number of other interesting players along the way. What were your thoughts on the Patriots draft, Mr. Irons?
More is always better, right? I mean, they traded the 23rd pick. They gathered more picks. They wound up moving up for a couple of guys they really wanted. The kid they drafted, I can't remember who it was, but it was Russillo. Russillo, who's rapidly climbing up the ranks of most loathed mediates in my life. Russillo said that they drafted a guy, and I'm paraphrasing here, that he came from a online university. And the dude is, by all accounts, is a physical freak. So, you know, they took as many kicks as they can. They did. They targeted the at least one of the two tight ends they moved up the trade from, the Dalton kid. So, I mean, I don't know anything about these guys. I'm not a huge fan of college football, but
you talk about Duggar?
No. Duggar's the kid from Lenoir Ryan, correct?
Yes. You said the Dalton kid. Oh, Dalton Keene. Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Dalton Keene, yeah. I've been had Andy Dalton shoved down my throat as the potential Patriots starting quarterback having post-traumatic stress at the redhead, the heat miser level.
We'll get into that. And I think, you know, I was talking with another beat reporter about this draft, and we thought it was really interesting because Nick Caserio came in after day two. Because now, just to give you the context, this is the day after they've traded down from number 23 to number 37. And so Caserio said at that point there were three players that they wanted to get, and that they got two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And by wanted to get, I think it's more like that they knew that there were three guys that they would absolutely draft if they were available. And they had got two of those guys, which, you know, now time will tell if they wanted the right guys, but good for them for getting guys that they wanted. Looking at the draft board, it seemed, I would guess that based on, you know, what they have on their roster and the potential roles that you could see some of these players fitting into between 23 and 37, my best guess is that the one guy they missed, if that guy came off the board before 37, that it might have been Xavier McKinney. I think that was probably the one guy we looked at and said, yeah, that was a good fit for the Patriots. And you know, that's pure conjecture. We don't have what they're looking for. But you start and you think, okay, the Patriots like to look for guys who can fill roles. So Duggar shapes up to be kind of the Chung role. And he's drawn a lot of comparisons to Patrick Chung since the moment he was drafted. And then you look at, okay, can McKinney, perhaps he could fill the McCourty role at safety. And that's sort of the way we're thinking. That was kind of what was up in the air, that if they missed out on anybody, it was only one player between 23 and 37.
And so Duggar can potentially fill the Harmon role in the near term as the third safety as well.
Yeah, right, and I think he will. I think that's probably how they'll ease him in. And they have to, you know, I'm sorry, they just got the guy from the Chargers. The special teams contributor, safety from the Chargers.
Adrian Phillips.
Phillips. And, you know, that gives them some options to fill that Harmon role, and they'll see who does what the best. But Duggar has a lot of reason. Now, he went to Lenoir Ryan, which is a D2 school, but there are a lot of things about him that you'd like. The physical stuff, the tools, seems to know what he's doing, and he was very competitive at the Senior Bowl, which is good competition, and that's something you like to see if you're drafting a guy who played in Division II.
Belichick's on record as saying they may not have been so eager to draft him unless they got to see him play against top college players.
And then I saw this guy, Jim Hackett. Do you know who Jim Hackett is?
I do not.
Okay. Jim Hackett, he's like a draft expert for EEI?
Oh, yes. I was furiously Googling his name like mediates when the Patriots took Duggar.
Well, he was saying that they overdrafted him, right? That they drafted him too early. They could have had him later, yada, yada,
false.
Yada. Bunch of stories came out that other teams were interested, and that Charlotte, Carolina, who had the next pick, was very interested. Now, I don't know if they would have drafted him or not, but supposedly Carolina very easily could have taken Duggar at 38. And, you know, it's funny. I think the way that we have this conversation about how a player could have lasted, that makes sense to us. Because we think like fantasy drafters that like everybody wants the good players and everybody, all of the, if I draft a player in fantasy, that player is going to be worth the same amount of points on my team as he is if he plays on your team at the end of the season. Doesn't Correct. Matter which one of us drafts him. We are going to get the exact same performance out of that player. Maybe you will bench him one week that I wouldn't have. But he's still going to score the same amount of points, no matter which team he's on. And in the NFL, it's a little different. We might disagree on who the best safety is or who the best player is. And it's not so much about, you know, should I take somebody right now who's more highly rated, or should I take the guy who fits my program? Those are the questions that NFL teams have to sort through. And I
come to mind when you say that. Mike Vrabel was an every guy in Pittsburgh. He was a fantastic player for the Patriots. The second one is Wes Welker was a jag in Miami. He got used to the nth degree with the Patriots.
Kyle Van Noy, second round draft pick.
And Bill Belichick's made a living out of taking people who are miscast in their roles and turning them into productive players and in Van Noy's case, and in Welker's case, I believe too, a compensatory pick on top of it.
Well, last year at some point, I think it was in the documentary with Nick Saban. Belichick said something along the lines of the hardest thing in coaching is figuring out, you know, you're going to tell a player to do their job, but figuring out what job that player should be doing, that is the challenge. And that's why you've seen a lot of players go somewhere else, and maybe they're trying to take somebody who was highly rated in the draft at a particular position, and they're trying to force a square peg into a round hole. And what the Patriots are doing is they're saying, and this is one of the keys to their success, has been they are less interested in fitting the square peg into the round hole. If the hole is round and there's a really good round peg out there, that's the guy they're going to draft, even if they could have done it later. And you have to start looking at this as an employer, right? Like if you're staffing your office, you know that there are certain jobs where you could choose, there could be like 200 candidates for that job. And there could be some great, you know, really bright people, but there's a very certain and particular set of skills that go into doing the job. And those—
You read my mind. Well, you're not going to take a cost accountant and have them close a sale.
Exactly. Right. And you might think, well, maybe I could try to get this guy to do that. He went to Harvard, right? Well, the guy went to Harvard. Maybe he'll be closing the sale. But if he went to Harvard and he can't close the sale, what good is that person to you to fill that role? They're not. They might have all the qualifications. They're going to have no trouble getting a job somewhere else, but they might not be the right person for your job that you're trying to fill.
They're just system quarterbacks, Dave. Plug and play.
Yes. Well, the Patriots want— – they don't want to sit there and draft the wrong guy because he was highly rated. They want the guy who's going to fit their system. And so if at the end of the day they've rated guys within a certain zone and said, okay, Kyle Duggar is like a second rounder, and if we get a chance somewhere between 30 and 50, we're going to draft him. That's more like how they work it, because they're simply not interested in drafting a player who they feel is going to be wrong for them or somebody who hasn't shown the skills that they're interested in. And the thing that people don't understand about the NFL draft is you have that top tier, you know, somewhere between 10 to 15 players who are like in a regular job pool. Those would be your Ivy League graduates who aced all their tests. They have degrees in multiple topics. They went the best internships, and they can do everything. Belichick talks about it like guys who check all the boxes. Those top of the draft guys, if you get one of them, you're in good shape. Most of those guys can fill your role on the Patriots. They have all the athletic talents. They can do more. They have more skills. And then the next tier is sort of like, okay, let's focus in on who can do these roles. And I think one of the problems and one of the reasons there's so much draft hate— I talked to a really smart person the day of the draft, and he said to me, why do I get frustrated every year with this? And I said, because your expectations are the wrong place. And I'm telling you, this is a really bright guy. Very good. He's a lawyer. He's a very good lawyer.
And it's a humble brag, Dave.
I'm telling you. No, it wasn't me. But he was a smart guy. And I'm like, I'm looking at him. I'm like, why would you be frustrated? You know, your expectations shouldn't be where they are.
You know why? Do you know why they're frustrated? It's the opposite of I heard of himitis. Yes. They want the sexy top pick. Nobody ever heard of Kyle Duggar when the pick was made. I certainly hadn't, other than what I read in mock drafts.
Right.
Yes, I read mock drafts. I feel
people
like
people aren't happy unless the media can tell them. First of all, the media spends a solid year filling their head with unreasonable expectations about what they need and who they should draft and who the best players are.
It's just so they can give a letter grade, Dave. That's all that's about.
I know. And it's like, and the letter grades are tailored to need. Well, okay, if the Patriots need a defensive lineman, but there are no defensive linemen in the draft who fit their roles for defensive line, they are not going to draft one, and that is the right thing to do. They can go find a free agent now who fills their role. They did it with Danny Shelton a couple years ago. there's still this other free agency period. You get more chances to go find and develop players. So so your draft capital is important. And if you see a chance to get the next Patrick Chung, then yes, that's where you spend your draft capital. You might be wrong. They're wrong all the time. 44% of second round picks are busts.
And Chung, his first go around, Chung was not very good because he was miscast.
That's right. Well, Belichick calls it one of his biggest mistakes was letting him go to Philadelphia when he came
back. That's arrogance, Dave. That's arrogance.
I know. When he came back, that's when Belichick figured out, okay, here's how I can use Patrick Chung. And
different role, completely different player. I mean, just he'll be vying for a red jacket someday.
Right, he should get it. Yes. But and we'll get into red jackets in a minute, but I think it's really important that, you know, people should understand that their expectations for the draft are driven by a sector of influence, being the media, who does not – they don't have all the information. You can have a really good evaluator. Let's say there was a – like let's say that best talent of an evaluator in the world worked for the Boston Globe and sat there and
that's a good evaluated
evaluated every player. At the end of the day, that person is still missing a huge and important piece of information, which is what exactly is it that Bill Belichick wants? What characteristics does he need to see in a player? And so you're looking for those very specific skills that person has to put on tape to show them before they're going to draft it. Now, that's my two cents because I'm not in that draft room either. But this is just from years of watching and not just watching the Patriots, but watching them consistently confound expectations. And so when I look at what they're trying to do, this is what makes the most sense to me. They talk all the time about roles. Belichick has said he would rather have he would simply rather trade down than draft the wrong player. And just because a player is the highest rated player at their position on the board does not mean that they're right for every single system. And so, you know, I think we get ourselves into these traps when people start grading the day after the draft, when people pump up Jake Fromm all year.
I heard of Hamitis.
He's gonna be a big steal. You know, he doesn't have the biggest arm, but you know, he played in Georgia, doing good things all day. All I heard throughout this draft was when I got to day three, the Patriots should take Jake Fromm.
Okay. They have to take a quarterback.
This idea that they needed a quarterback to begin with, completely silly. But Fromm, okay, let me ask you this. Jake Fromm, he went, I think, in the fifth round. But let's say it was the fourth round. Why do you need the fourth rounder from Georgia? Why? Oh, because Jarrett Stidham, the fourth rounder from Auburn, is the only quarterback you have. Well, what's the significant difference there? I mean, yes, they have different skills. They're a little bit different stylistically. And Fromm doesn't really have the big arm, which doesn't matter to me. There are plenty of nice quarterbacks that don't have the big arm. But looking at Fromm and looking at Stidham, neither of whom have any significant playing time in the NFL, what are you so excited about with Fromm that you're not now? If Stidham had come out in this draft, he's probably the third highest quarterback, and he probably goes before the fourth round. So the Patriots kind of jumped in line. They kind of did a little Larry Bird move, getting Stidham in the fourth round a year early. But everyone
in effect draft and stashed him. Correct.
Right. Almost. Yeah. And there has sort of been this presumption that the Patriots don't have enough at quarterback. And it seems the only observers or the only people in this equation who do not share that opinion are the New England Patriots, who let Jameis Winston and Andy Dalton go to other teams. Now, those two guys who the entire national media has been trying to force down New England's throat for months those two guys both signed on as backups. In Winston in New Orleans and Dalton in Dallas. Okay? Both signed up to be backups. Not the entire league passed. The entire league said, no, thank you. We don't want you to be our starting quarterback. For some reason, the Patriots are held to a different standard where they were supposed to take a guy that the other 31 teams just weren't interested in. Okay. So then, and then you have Cam Newton. And Newton's a very interesting story. Newton has had in his career one absolutely great season 5 years ago. But his second best season, I think, in looking at all the numbers, was 2018. And then last year he was injured, missed all but two games. And so he intrigues a lot of people. I don't know
if because he's a name. He's been over 60% as a passer in his career twice.
Right. Yeah. And okay. And so the argument then becomes, well, Bill Belichick could fix him. You know what I mean? Like the Patriots can always just fix everybody. Part of the reason that they're good at fixing people is because they bring in people who have the skills they're looking for. That's sometimes people underperform. We already talked about the Kyle Van Noy's. But Belichick knows what he wants and he knows who can do it. If they at some point bring in Newton, great. But that they haven't should tell you what you need to know about Jarrett Stidham. And Newton, how much money is that guy going to make? 10 million, 20 million, somewhere in that range.
And it's also tough to tell where he's at physically in the current environment. Yes. It's not like you can fly him into town and run to the doctor's office and see what's up with his body.
And he's not the most accurate passer. He's had two really good passing years, but he's not the most accurate passer. And
the best aspect of his game might be severely limited now, his mobility and his ability to run.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, we don't know where that is. So
he's a 31-year-old quarterback who's 250 pounds, who's taking an absolute – he's gotten the living shit kicked out of him the last couple of years, and he missed most of the last season.
And I don't even want this to read like a takedown off Cam Newton. You can be a decent quarterback and not right for a team. And I don't know that he's right for this situation because if he winds up making, let's say, $15 million, okay, Jarrett Stidham makes $800,000. That is 18 times Stidham's salary that you'd have to pay him. And they could probably work it out.
And if Stidham's good, you have a quarterback on a rookie contract. That's the biggest advantage in the sport.
It's huge. And, okay, so let's say, but you know what? You can make the argument that like, okay, but if some people, this is how they phrase it. This is their argument. They say, if the Patriots were interested in winning this year, they would pay Newton now and go to Stidham next year. Which, okay, but then you don't really develop Stidham. You're exactly where you started. You know what I mean? And then
that transitions into the asinine tanking argument.
Oh, we'll get to that in just a second. But let's just ponder Newton. If he makes $15 million, he gets Stidham with $800,000. So that's 18 times more than Stidham. Is Cam Newton 18 times better than Jarrett Stidham? I don't think so. Or even at 10 million, is he like 12 times better than Stidham? I don't think so. Plus, to fit Newton, you then have to either restructure some contracts or you have to cut some players. So you're either moving some dead money down the road, which you'll have to deal with, or you're going to have less talent around you. I will take and I don't even know how they could do a $15 million deal right now without cutting somebody. So I'll take the $800,000 quarterback. It's a very good football reason to look at Stidham because if he's good this year, they're in fantastic shape. If he's a year away, then this is the year you use to get him there. And then on the other side of the rainbow, there's a ton of free cap space, and your quarterback will be making around $1 million something. They'll be making less than two, I think. So, and they'll have 2 more years of a cheap quarterback with a ton of cap space because the Brady money goes away. They might even get some Antonio Brown money back. So all of this seems to make sense. The Patriots have not even appeared to glance at those people. The reports that we've heard say that they're not interested in Newton. I think Jeff Howe and others have reported that. And so But then we keep hearing this argument, which I like to call the doesn't make sense argument, where you use your own ignorance as the argument. People say, I don't understand why Pete Carroll didn't run the ball. Okay, well, there's go read about it. There's plenty of information out there to explain why in Super Bowl 49, Pete Carroll chose to throw. Stop being ignorant and stop using your ignorance as the argument.
And we had a Seattle media member, Danny O'Neill, on who agreed with the decision.
he did, right?
Yes,
he agreed with the decision to throw. But it should have been, and I think Guy said the same thing. It shouldn't have been thrown to the middle of the end zone. Okay. You derailed me with trying to fact check Danny O'Neill. So
you're welcome.
So these arguments where, and we see this in football all the time, where the premise is somebody is so deviating from the acceptable wisdom of football that I don't even have to articulate to myself why they might be right. That the premise is Bill Belichick is so wrong in not signing Cam Newton that all I have to say is, I don't understand why he doesn't sign Cam Newton. I don't get it. Well, think about it for a second. You have to look at the salaries. You have to do the salary cap analysis. And you have to say to yourself, is Cam Newton that much better than Jarrett Stidham? And when you sit down at the end of the day, it's tough to talk yourself into the idea that he is. You also have to consider that Cam Newton has not played in this offense. So he has to come here and learn it. Jarrett Stidham has been working in it for a year. And do you remember in the Tom Brady NFL 100, did you watch that?
Yes.
Do you remember what Belichick said about the week that Bledsoe came back to practice in 2001?
I don't.
Okay. So he said that he had them both share reps that week. And that Brady did not play. It might have even been the Rams game. No.
It was the Saints game.
The Saints game. And Brady, he said, did he let Brady start? You know, he kept Brady as a starter, and Brady did not have a great game. And after that game, now Belichick could have done the easy thing. He could have gone and said, I'll start Bledsoe next week. I'll play it safe. No one's going to second guess me on that. But Belichick's conclusion was, I did Tom a disservice. I took practice reps away from him that would have helped him get ready for this game. And I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to deprive him of the reps that he needs to get ready.
That's right.
If you bring in, and everybody wanted to bring in Winston or Dalton to compete for the job, or draft Jake Fromm to compete for the job, if you're going to bring in one of those guys to compete for the starting job, you are now sharing those reps throughout training camp. How are you getting – if you bring in Fromm, how are you getting either of those guys ready? How are you getting Dalton, who hasn't played this offense, or Winston, who hasn't played this offense, and Winston, who threw 30 interceptions last year for Tampa in a new offense? How?
That's why Hoyer fits, yes, because he's familiar with the offense.
Exactly. Hoyer not only do they not have to teach him the offense, he knows it to the point where he can be useful to Stidham. So you don't have two guys, you know, who are 1 and 1A trying to figure out what to do. You have one guy who's going to be the starter, and he's going to figure it out. Although there was that Ian Rappaport story that said Brian Hoyer was currently like the clubhouse leader for that position. Of course, that report.
Hold on, Ian Rappaport? He of the Patriots can use a premium pick on a quarterback?
I was surprised. I didn't think I was going to be able to get it out. I thought you would jump on this immediately. Yes, in the same report where he told us they were going to use a, quote, premium pick on a quarterback, we found out that Brian Hoyer is going to be the starter. I don't think any other report backs that up yet, but let's acknowledge that and leave that as a possibility for the season whenever it starts, should it ever start.
The Rappaports and the Breers of the world should leave the actual reporting to the adults in the room and not just go back to reporting NFL PR. Just be the stenographer.
So let me ask you, now the tanking story. So now the I mean, oh my God, who is that guy? Sam Munson. Oh my God.
Oh, the Pro Football Farkas guys.
Oh, like
there's no bigger the snake oil of the snake oil of the football world.
Listen, Pro Football Focus had there's a lot of people there. Okay. One of them, what's that guy's name? His last name begins with a P. It's an Italian
Steve
name.
Palazzolo.
He's Palazzolo. Listen.
Furiously Googling
every,
right
every
now.
Tweet I've ever seen from that guy, I've been like, it's like a new stat that hammers home a point about Tom Brady. And I feel like he's done a really good job with those.
Steve Palazzolo.
They got a whole bunch of guys there sit and watch football, and some of them I can't get on board with. But I like his tweets. I think sometimes he's good. That's not a vouch. Nope. I'm just saying I think he's sharp. Okay.
That did not go where I expected it to go. I disregard everything immediately when it comes to Pro Football Focus, and it kind of kills me when people who I enjoy reading cite it as gospel truth.
And it's not gospel truth. You know what I like it for? I like when they sit down and grade all the players and then just go ahead and throw away all the grades. Who's at the top of the list and who's at the bottom of the list? Because you know what? Your grade might not be perfect, and the guy at the top of the list might not be the best player, but he had a good year. They're not putting a guy at the top of the list who was a total mess all season. You know what I mean? So if I see that, like, oh, you know, my favorite team signed the third best guard from last year, according to Pro Football Focus, I think, well, maybe he's not the third best. Maybe he's the seventh best, but you can live with that. He's not the bottom. He's not the 32nd best guard. So, okay. That's where I deviate from you a little bit on Pro Football Focus. But this guy, Sam Munson, I'm not even going to read the tweet, but it was completely ridiculous about how Bill Belichick is like, he's going to, if he plays Stidham, their best chance is to win like 7 games or something, or 9 games maybe. And what they should do is, they're only doing this because Belichick is really playing chess. He's just trying to get Trevor Lawrence, and because the tank for Trevor is the, you know, it's alliterative, so therefore everyone thinks it's true. Tank for Trevor. And this is what the Patriots are doing. They're just trying to lose all their games so they can get this guy. I don't understand the theory how 3 wins gets you Trevor Lawrence, because somebody will win 2 or 1. And you're going to need the first pick because he's the top-rated quarterback in that draft going back a couple of years. There's so much hype around him, he's probably going to be number one.
They said the same thing about Tagovailoa last year too, though, and he wound up going fifth. True.
Right, barring like a major injury that wipes out his season, you know? A pandemic or something. Actually, if there's a pandemic, Trevor Lawrence – if pandemic wipes out that season, Lawrence is number one.
Fair enough.
But okay, so supposedly, they're tanking for Trevor. Why would they give Devin McCourty $17 million guaranteed over the next 2 years? Why would they franchise tag Joe Tooney? Okay, they can trade him, but they haven't traded him yet. Why are they making all of these moves for this year when they're supposedly tanking for Trevor? And never mind that, like, I find it appalling and intellectually dishonest that someone would suggest that this is what Bill Belichick would do.
Well, I mean, that's the phrase that is correct, intellectually dishonest. Right? All this is, and it's nothing more than that. It's stirring the pot to do content in a dead time, and it's brain dead. It has people who believe this shit have an IQ of 98.5. That's all it is, Dave.
Is that good?
Is that a trolling number? Allegedly.
Well, so Sam Munson, and the reason I single him out, and I'll be fair and I'll say he's not the first person to think of this. He won't be the last to talk about it. But his take was so like when I was in law school, sometimes he'd be sitting there in class and he'd be listening to someone ask a question and he'd go, this guy is so smart that he's talked himself all the way back around to stupid. Like, he just abandoned and just shoved off all common sense and everything he knows about the world and cloaked himself so tightly in legal theory that, like, he's just lost it. Like what you're saying doesn't add up. That's just not what humans are like. And we know what Bill Belichick is like. He's not playing chess to get Trevor Lawrence. And if he were going to do that, he wouldn't bring back Devin McCourty, which Devin McCourty could have gone other places. He wouldn't have been this disrespectful to McCourty, who might be in his final year. I don't think he would have stolen this opportunity from him to go in somewhere else. I don't think that they would have made a lot of the moves that they've made. So, yeah, I don't know.
It's an asinine premise. I mean, who knows? Maybe they don't have a very good season next year, but it has nothing to do with them tanking at all.
It is the sledgehammer thinking of the quarterback position, that the only way you can win is by going out and grabbing the best quarterback in a particular draft. Well, you know what? Go look through history. Go look at the top quarterbacks taken in every draft. They're not all Peyton Manning. And Peyton Manning wasn't even Tom Brady, who was a sixth-round pick. Everyone just ejects all the reason out of their heads. And then these two big letters come into focus, QB. And they think the whole team's the quarterback. And people do, you see like that dumb show First Take or whatever their competitors are on the other network with Nick Wright.
The yelling shows.
All those yelling shows. And it's like, the AFC East is terrible. Well, what quarterbacks have they had? It's like, okay, those teams that the Patriots played against for the last 20 years were comprised of more than quarterbacks. And there were some good ones, Chad Pennington, so forth, but you have to look at more than just that position. And we've gotten ourselves so stupid about quarterback that this idea has emerged that the only way forward is to plunge into an embarrassing mess of a season, and then you get rewarded with your savior. Well, saviors don't always save you. We can go – like Sam Darnold was, what, the third or fourth overall pick?
Yeah, for every Sam Darnold who's a competent quarterback, there's a Josh Rosen who was picked in the same draft, yes, and was terrible.
I mean, that draft should tell you everything you need to know. Rosen, Darnold, I mean, Mayfield, okay, he's off to a nice start, I guess. He's the best one out of that group so far. Patrick Mahomes wasn't the first quarterback taken.
Went 10th overall.
Right. They traded up to get him.
There's a fundamental lack of understanding on the yelling shows, and particularly in Boston media. Is quarterback an important position? Of course it is. It's the most important position on the field. Football is still a complementary game. The 2001 Super Bowl champions, Tom Brady threw 18 touchdowns and 12 interceptions in 14 starts that year. He didn't light it up. He didn't throw for 50 touchdowns and have 7 interceptions like he did in 2007. There are more than one way to win a football game. And they will be different next year. They'll be less quarterback dependent on offense. One would think.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you go back through, first of all, look at the quarterbacks Bill Belichick has drafted. Brady in the 6th round, Matt Cassel in the 7th. Both those guys went to Pro Bowls. Jimmy G was in the 2nd round. That's like, I think that's the highest he's ever drafted a quarterback.
That's correct.
I mean, let's hear some names from the last decade of quarterbacks taken in the 1st round. Josh Allen, 7th overall. Jake Locker, number 8 in 2011. Imagine what you could have done with that pick instead of drafting Jake Locker. Brandon Wheaton, 22nd overall in 2012. And right after that, undrafted Brian Hoyer became the winningest quarterback in the history of that team. Imagine if they had used pick number 22 on a position, on a player in another position. Okay.
No podcasts in the Patriots podcast universe are bigger fans of anybody than we are of Brian Hoyer.
I know. We're like, I saw him at Whole Foods once. I was very excited. Let's see. Lamar Jackson. Good pick. So far, Josh Freeman, 2009, number 17. Ooh. Sam Darnold, number 3. Mark Sanchez, number 5. Blake Bortles, number 3. Teddy Bridgewater, 11. Have I named one Super Bowl winner yet? Robert Griffin III, number 2 overall. Sam Bradford, number 1 overall.
Captain Checkdown.
Mitch Trubisky. They traded up to number 2 for no reason. They took Mitch Trubisky. The Bears just denied his fifth-year option. And you know what's going to happen is he's going to have an awesome year, and they're going to overpay him, and then he's going to stink again. Tannehill, number 8. Mariota, number 2, right after number 1, Jameis Winston in that draft. Are you sensing a pattern here?
I sense Carson, a pattern, Dave.
Carson Wentz, number 2. They won the Super Bowl with somebody else.
What you're doing, all you're doing is you're combining the two shiniest objects in the media universe. Number 1 draft pick overall and the quarterback position. And it's crossing the streams and the idiocy reverses and blows up in their face.
Matt Stafford. You know what? Matt Stafford has had a nice career.
Stat humper.
Probably overrated. But let's even if we make the argument that Matt Stafford is good, the Lions, he didn't save them. Didn't save the Lions. Andrew Luck, number 1 overall pick, probably the most consensus guy, excellent player. You know what? They never put the pieces around him. They got smoked in the 2014 AFC Championship, and that was the last we saw of the Colts. Luck kept getting hurt. They just never put the complete team around him.
Well, they didn't go to the Super Bowl because the balls were deflated in that game. Let's be honest. I'm just asking the question, caller.
Jared Goff.
Oh.
Got him to a Super Bowl. You know? Okay. Probably don't regret that pick. Deshaun Watson, good pick. But you know what? What have they done? Still a team that struggles. And by the way, I think he's a really good quarterback. The point here is, even when you hit, you still have other team building to do.
10 other guys on the offense and 11 other guys on defense and special teams, despite what some almost coaches say, is also an important part of the game. It'll be a very important part of the game for a Patriot team that's likely to be less explosive next year.
Mahomes won a Super Bowl, and Cam Newton got his team to a Super Bowl. So that's it. Think about that, okay? Everyone bending over backwards to grab a quarterback as soon as they can. And what evidence is there that it's the best? Like I was saying yesterday on Twitter, I said I felt like the position is overvalued, that it is the most important position, but that teams still overvalue it. And somebody said to me something along the lines of, well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, the Patriots had the best quarterback, and they went to the most Super Bowls. You know what else they did? They consistently underpaid him. They drafted him in the 6th round, and then they didn't give him enough money. Like, they properly value the quarterback position. You take a bunch of shots, and every once in a while, you hit a Tom Brady or a Matt Castle or a Jimmy Garoppolo. We'll find out what Jarrett Stidham is, but I don't necessarily know that the key to winning is drafting a quarterback in the top 5. I don't know. Right?
I couldn't agree with you more. Well put.
All right.
You're absolutely right, Dave.
Thank you. I felt like we had a plan for this podcast, and oh my God. Yeah. The other part.
It's really unlike us to go off the rails, isn't it?
Red jackets. You know what? I'm looking at our plan that we talked about earlier, and I feel like we've only talked about things we said that we were going to talk about. So I think we're doing good. Red jackets. It comes up a lot. We've probably talked about it briefly on this podcast. Bill Parcells. Should Bill Parcells be in the Patriots Hall of Fame?
No.
Well, I don't understand the argument for Bill Parcells. I'm with you. And it is a very controversial and passionate topic.
You had a history as a fan with Bill Parcells before I did.
Yeah. Yeah. I listen, when I say that Bill Parcells shouldn't be in the Patriots Hall of Fame, people come at me and they say, why do you hate Bill Parcells? I love Bill Parcells. I love when he's coaching the Giants. I actually thought it was pretty cool when he came to Foxborough, because it was like, oh, I know him. I could kind of keep an eye on the Patriots too. They're like 20 minutes from my house. Great. You know, like Sarah Palin watching Russia over there. Like, great. But I think here's why. Okay, so first let me lay this out. These arguments are made that are incorrect. First, that Bill Parcells was responsible for a boom in tickets and in season tickets. Not true. Ticket sales did go up during his first season, but it wasn't until Robert Kraft bought the team a year later that that's when they started selling out every game, and they've sold out every game since. And the reason for that is there was like one of the things that kept tickets from being sold when Parcells got here was that there was a major concern among the fan base that the team was going to leave.
And absolutely, there was. It at the end of Parcells' first season, the 16th game against Miami, WEEI that week, that Dale Arnold, who's buried more co-hosts than Michael Corleone has his enemies, Dale Arnold and Eddie Endelman put together this late at the gate thing where they didn't want the fans to go into the stadium until I think it was the second quarter as a means of protest. Because I remember thinking it was a fait accompli that the Patriots are going to St. Louis.
Well, right. And they were owned by James Orthwine, who, and this also bleeds into this idea that Parcells saved the franchise, which is just hurts my brain. But this idea, okay, Orthwine owned the team. He wanted to move them to St. Louis. That's where he's from. So the NFL and so many people know this, but I'll just recount it for those who don't. The NFL had a rule that you couldn't break your lease with a stadium. They would not let Orthwine break the lease. So he went to the person who owned the stadium and said, hey, we have a lease through 2000 or something. I think it's 2000.
2001, I believe.
Oh, it must have been 2001. Right, 2001. Because
Bob Kraft bought the stadium out of bankruptcy a few years prior as a way he was getting his chess pieces aligned to try to buy the team.
Yes. Yes. And so Orthwine went to Bob Kraft and said, I will give you $75 million if you let me out of this lease. Kraft turned him down, and then Kraft turned around, I think, bought him for $145.
Correct, right in that area. Million,
like in 1990, in early 1994. So Bob Kraft kept the team here. There's, even if he had never bought the team, it's here because Robert Kraft decided he wanted the Patriots to be in Foxborough more than he wanted $75 million. Okay? So if you ever call Robert Kraft cheap, think that through. Okay? Because instead of taking his $75 million and going and he's a shrewd businessman. He could have gone and invested that anywhere. Instead of doing that, he kept the team here, knowing that Orthwine could still yet sell it to somebody else. Okay? So that's two myths dispelled. Parcells didn't make the ticket boom, didn't save the franchise. So the next thing is supposedly about culture. Bill Parcells came here and changed the culture, basically starting the dynasty. Okay. He was the coach for 4 years. They went 32-32 in the regular season. They won as many playoff games as they lost. They lost a playoff game to the Browns in, was it 94? Coached by?
94 wild card game, coached by Bill Belichick.
Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick beat Bill Parcells in that wild card game.
By Bill Parcells' own admission, his own admission, he did a dog shit job the next year after they went to the playoffs in 94. In 95, they reverted and they went 6-10. He wasn't – he
culture.
Was not – he admitted that he was not invested and he did not do a good job. He didn't put his all into it and had to refocus and reinvigorate for the 96 season after he negotiated to get a year taken off his contract.
You want to talk about the Patriots culture, you talk about focus, you talk about doing your job, and you talk about the pursuit of the goal, which is to win the Super Bowl. The week of the Super Bowl, the head coach was negotiating with the Jets. What culture is that? How does that? Bill Belichick, listen, Bill Belichick isn't going to stay in a situation that he doesn't like. He might have left too. But you know what he wouldn't have done? He wouldn't have been on the phone with the Jets the week of the Super Bowl, because Bill Belichick wants to win that Super Bowl. And he's come out and said that he felt that Bill Parcells mishandled that situation. Okay? That's the example he was setting for his team in 1996.
He was playing footsie with Steve Gutman and Leon Hess while they were drawing up a totally terrible game plan to try to beat the Packers in that game, relying on Drew Bledsoe, who threw four picks in Super Bowl 31 after he had a dog shit game in the divisional round and an even worse AFC title game against Jacksonville.
And then, okay, so then we get to the other part of the myth. Well, wait. The culture part of the myth, right? The culture or the totally changed everything. How does that culture last through the next 3 years? After Parcells leaves and before Belichick comes in, how is there a continuity of culture when Pete Carroll is in the middle? And Pete Carroll's coaching style is like the opposite end of the spectrum from Bill Parcells. Very player-oriented, very friendly, high-fiving all the fans on his way out. Look, you and I exchange Pete Carroll gifts on Twitter all of the time. And the reason they're hypnotically amusing is because Pete Carroll, even when he's upset, is just so pleasant. Like, he's frustratingly pleasant, okay? He's a completely different person from Bill Parcells. Explain to me what culture was continuing through the Pete Carroll administration.
There was none. It's everything.
Everything what? Are you with me?
Are you hearing that?
Am I hearing what?
Oh, never mind.
Was there a gunk? Did you hear a gunk?
No, I'm getting some. Oh, there we go. It was on my end. The culture argument doesn't hold water for me because, first of all, what culture was there, as we mentioned, when the coach is playing footsie with your divisional rival? And it always happens. It happens in every sport. Parcells was perceived to be a disciplinarian and hard charging, and they brought in the polar opposite. Look, they brought in the players coach, that sort of thing. And it went to hell in a handbasket. More to the point.
He did a pretty good job. I don't want to undersell that. He got them to a Super Bowl. That's good. He did not draft Rick Meyer. That's good. But the other part of this conversation comes up and says, but Parcells drafted the core of the first championship team.
He drafted the core of the first championship team. However, he left to go be the exec and coach with the Jets because he wanted to shop for the groceries.
He didn't draft. Oh, yes, exactly. Right. Supposedly, he wasn't allowed to draft players, but somehow he drafted the players? How does that add up? Because there was this big fight in the 96 draft over Terry Glenn. And Parcells wanted to draft Tony Brackens, who wound up going to – where were the Patriots drafting in 96?
I believe they were drafting sixth. I'm trying to pull it up here. They picked seventh overall.
Seventh overall.
And they took Terry Glenn. They took Terry Glenn from Ohio State. That was the genesis. That was the beginning of the end. Okay? So it's Glenn, established at this point. The Terry Glenn pick, Parcells was out. The next two picks after that were Lawyer Malloy and Teddy Bruschi,
right,
the two stalwarts on the Super Bowl, the first three Super Bowl, on the first Super Bowl team, and Bruschi is a generational player.
And none of those three players were chosen by Parcells. He bailed on the 96 draft after Terry Glenn. Parcells wanted Tony Brackens, who turned out to be a pretty good defensive end.
He's on record. His plan was to draft Brackens, and I believe Mohsin Muhammad was on their sights in the second round. Another pretty
not a terrible plan. Not a terrible plan. If they had wound up with those two players, no one would look and be like, oh, Bill Parcells messed up. Brackens had double-digit sacks in 99 and in 01. He had a good career. No real question. Mohsin Muhammad. Patriots saw him in a Super Bowl. But – playing for
Glenn and Malloy started as rookies on an AFC championship team.
Yeah, I mean, listen. Parcells' ideas weren't terrible, but he didn't draft the guys who became.
No one's saying Bill Parcells is a dummy.
Dynasty.
Parcells is obviously a good football guy. He's inherently flawed in that when he was with the Giants, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, he was making googly eyes at other jobs because he has, you know, the four-year itch. He wants to get out and move on.
Yes.
He did it with the Jets, too. He left the Jets. He wound up working for the Dolphins and for the Cowboys.
I think he
reversed that order, I believe.
With the Giants, I know at one point he was thinking of leaving for Tampa. I'm trying to remember if it was before or after they won their first Super Bowl. But it really doesn't matter. Look, and I can't – look, the guy is fidgety. He didn't want to stay in one place for too long. That's his business, whatever. But when you look at it in the context of should he be in the Patriots Hall of Fame? Well, he was here for 4 years. None of the arguments that people make for him being in that Hall of Fame really hold up. They just don't hold up. Now, I think here's what happened. First of all, Bob Kraft did not endear himself to the local media on his way in. And Parcells did. So he always kind of had the media on his side. And I think the media, there's a lot of media around here who liked that he filled their notebooks and took the time to talk to them. And then there's things that are as crazy as the Dan Shaughnessy breakfast with Robert Kraft. And I think there is sort of a, even when it's not intentional, there is this desire to favor the Parcells' importance over Kraft's importance. But part of the reason that resonates, and the reason that the fans who support Parcells in this argument, the reason that they get on board with it is because there was this horrible 4-year period before. And a lot of fans were coming of age. I know I was, that when I was starting to get into football, the Patriots were really bad. And while they had two consecutive bad coaches, Rod Rust and Dick McPherson, they also had two terrible ownership situations. They had the Sullivan ownership situation was falling apart. He was going bankrupt, sold the team, sold the stadium. And he sold the team to Victor Kiam, which was another bad ownership situation. I believe he wanted to move. And so that was the beginning. And then he sold to Orthwine, who wanted to move. And that was the beginning of sort of a, you know, this multi-year period where fans are like, if I buy season tickets, the team's going to move next year. So I'm paying it. Well, am I going to give money to the guy who wants to take my team away?
Well, I think more to the point, the team wasn't very good and they didn't draw.
And they weren't good.
The reverse is true. In the middle, from 82 until 88, they were over 500 every year. They went to a Super Bowl. They were in the playoffs three times. When the team is good, it's the same in all four sports in Boston. The teams are good. The people will show up. The Red Sox were bad in the middle 80s and in the early 90s. Fenway Park was empty at nights during the week.
When you're 10 years old in 1990, I was 11. I was 11 in 1990. So I was six when they went to that Super Bowl. The only reason that I really remember that Super Bowl is that my dad taped it. And I, from time to time, would watch it. Because, you know, you had those, like, 85 Bears with – I mean, really, I was, like, watching the fridge score touchdowns, okay, or a touchdown. Because you just – where else are you going to see that, right? So I would watch that tape from time to time. That's why I remember the Patriots were good. But if you're 5 or 6 years old in 1985, you're starting to come of age and really get into football around 1990, that doesn't register with you that they were good a few years ago. So your whole memory of the Patriots is that they were terrible up until, now I'm going to get into this. Here's Bill Parcells. Here's Drew Bledsoe. Let's go. There was a lot of enthusiasm. There was a feeling that this was all going somewhere.
There's a nostalgia for that era, and I remember how excited I was when they won the last four games in the 93 season, and Bledsoe hit Timpson down the right sideline in overtime for a touchdown. It was a fantastic football game, and it was just – I just remember feeling – I was with a bunch of my friends. I just remember feeling, oh, they can't leave on this. They can't leave on this.
This feeling,
and there was a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, well, this feeling is like what the fans who vote for Parcells, for the Patriots Hall of Fame, what they want is they want to honor that enthusiasm and how great that 4-year period was for them, but they're connecting dots that can't be connected to make his Hall of Fame case worthy. And yes, he is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And there are plenty of people who go into the Pro Football Hall of Fame but aren't honored by every organization they played for. Kurt Warner is not going to go in the New York Giants Hall of Fame. He played there one season and he wasn't particularly great. So I can't wrap my head around it.
It's media driven. He made their jobs easy. It really is just that simple.
Well, and then I see these fans who are so insistent that the Patriots didn't do anything before 1993. And it's like they had a downturn of 4 years. And in a decade that's bookended by Super Bowl appearances, like they were very Raymond Berry has every right to be in the Patriots Hall of Fame.
Put Chuck Fairbanks in, put Ray Berry in, and then we'll talk about Parcells.
And I mean, right now Parcells is up against Richard Seymour and Mike Vrabel. Richard Seymour should already be in. Like, that shouldn't even be a question. In fact, it's hilarious that he almost got into Canton before he got a red jacket. Okay? But first of all, Seymour, hands down, he's the guy. It should be Seymour. Then it should be Vrabel. Then it should be like a dozen other guys from the first dynasty. Then you have to go through all the guys from the second wave who won the second three championships. Then you got to put in Fairbanks. You got to put in Berry. You got to put in, you know, you got to put in Dante Scarnecchia long before you put in Bill Parcells.
Amen. Amen to that.
Dante Scarnecchia has been here since before I was born, right? Like since the 70s?
He was with the team in the early days. I know he was with the Berry team. He went to Indianapolis for 1 year and he's been with the Patriots continuously since the early 90s.
He was there for almost, and there were times when he left and came back, but
that's right.
Over a period of about 4 decades, Dante Scarnecchia was part of this franchise. And I think he was there for the first Super Bowl.
In 85, I do believe he was with the 85 team, correct.
He didn't go to all 10, but because he took some time off in the past decade. But, I mean, let's wrap our heads around this. Dante Scarnecchia should be in there. Like, they should induct Scarnecchia 10 times before they put Parcells in, okay? Amen. But then, by this point, Belichick probably is retired, so you got to put him in. And what about Ron Perkins?
Ray Perkins.
Sorry. What about Ray Perkins?
He of the Perkins Air Hot offense?
He co-created the offense that Charlie Weiss adapted and they won all these championships with and made Tom Brady's career. What about Charlie Weiss? You got to put Charlie Weiss in before you put in Bill Parcells.
Romeo.
Josh McDaniels someday, maybe. Like,
you know what it is? It's easy content. I'm referencing this became a conversation point because Curran wrote an article about it with the Patriots having their Hall of Fame. It's a no-brainer.
Which side was he on?
It's an absolute – if Richard Seymour doesn't get in, vote Big C. I'm not sure official how any of these rankings are, but Seymour and Vrabel, you know, Vrabel was obviously a fantastic Patriot. He played for the team 7 years, I believe. But it's a no-brainer. Richard Seymour is a Hall of Famer, and he played most of his career at the Patriots. No-brainer.
Richard Seymour, 100%. That's the guy you got to vote for.
Although his draft grade was an F in the Boston Globe because he was too tall to play tackle and too slow to play end.
Richard Seymour, I'm sorry. The Tom Curran thing from this week. Tom, in 2016 – put out a piece or there's a video of it somewhere where he talks about how he was changing his mind, that he was pro Parcells, but now he's anti Parcells in 2016. In 2020, he's now pro Parcells. So He was for it before he was against it, and then against it before he was for it.
I don't know of any company, if you put this in terms of, you know, your own life, I don't know of any company who would put an executive's picture on the wall who is playing footsie with their competitor during the most important period in the company's history.
I know. And then, I mean, we haven't even talked about all the stuff he did with the Jets. Like,
he did everything he could to stick it to the Patriots. The Curtis Martin poison pill contract is at the top of the list.
Dirty pool there. And then, okay, so another part of the argument is
I'm still doing the Clave and Shake over the fact that they only gave Curtis Martin the ball 14 times in Super Bowl 31.
When in that postseason, this is a great stat. In that postseason, Drew Bledsoe's adjusted net yards per attempt was something like 2.5 yards. And Curtis Martin in that postseason ran for like 5 yards a carry. Like they were getting
the Hall of Famer on that offense touched the goddamn football 14 times in the biggest game of the year.
I mean, it's rare that your running is going to be more efficient than your passing. But that was true in that Super Bowl, and they did not run. Now they were behind, so you got to pass more.
They were ahead 14-13 in that game.
But in the fourth quarter, they were down by
– Yeah, after the Desmond Howard return. Bledsoe turned the ball over 6 times in that postseason.
Ooh. Yeah, that's not good. Okay. So –
Check that. 7. So two interceptions against Pittsburgh, two interceptions against Pittsburgh, 1 interception in the AFC title game, which they really didn't, lean on him much in that game at all, and then 4 in the Super Bowl.
The idea that Parcells was responsible for Belichick becoming the coach is in like a butterfly effect kind of sense, slightly true. But he then did it's indirectly true. Like Belichick came to the Patriots organization because Parcells wanted him.
Right. And they had, because if Kraft has a previous relationship with Belichick, you know, again, that's probably somewhat true. If you have a relationship with somebody previously, you're going to probably, if he's a candidate for the job, you're going to look at him a little bit more closely than the others because it's the person you know.
And he went and talked to players from that time who had worked with Belichick and asked for their sense of what he was like. So that is like the most direct contribution Bill Belichick made to getting – I'm sorry, that Parcells made to getting Belichick the job.
Lawyer Malloy said in the 2001 America's Game that when Bob Kraft asked him
– Yes.
Invited him into his office, the only person he wanted to talk about was Bill Belichick.
Right. Well, okay. And
Dom Capers was the other guy. Oy vey.
Yes. Yes. Well, okay. So supposedly we're going to give Parcells credit for all this. I'm going to take some of that credit away because of the fact that he did everything he could to keep Belichick from leaving the Jets.
Oh, held him. Absolutely held him. I mean, there's plenty of fault. As is with the Kraft Parcells thing, there's a lot of blame on both sides. The Belichick Jets thing, you know, It's pretty clear what Belichick, he didn't want to work for the unknown after Leon Hess died. And he was right. He was right about Gutman and the entire ownership situation.
Nailed it. And, you know, Parcells did everything he could to keep Belichick from coming here to the point where they had a grievance hearing. And Charlie Weiss gave key testimony to suggest what Belichick's role was in the Jets organization. And that testimony allowed the Patriots to effectively hire Belichick. And Parcells revoked Weiss's access to Giant Stadium the next day. And bitterly held a grudge. I think still holds a grudge against Charlie Weiss for that sin.
I believe you're correct.
He and Belichick are on good terms. But he still can't forgive Weiss for that. That's how much he wanted to keep Bill Belichick from being in New England.
Well, Parcells won the back page of the New York Post that day because he did get a first round pick in return for Belichick being released to go poach the Patriots.
Imagine how good they might have been if they had another first round pick in 2000.
Yeah, it's a good point by you.
Because what
Jets had four first round picks in the 2000 draft.
Wow. Well, I'm glad it worked out for them. this is exhausting. This is just mentally exhausting having this argument for days, trying to explain to people, like seeing young people who came of age during this time of like from the Dark Ages into the Bledsoe Parcells era, and thinking that was, and having no idea that they were actually averaging 38,500 a game in 1992, and that the team was pretty popular in Boston. The first episode of Cheers, I believe they mentioned the Patriots before any other team. Before they even mentioned that Sam used to pitch for the Red Sox. Because Coach comes in to the bar in the morning when it's opening up, and the first thing he wants to do is complain about the draft. And Coach is upset because they didn't get a jackrabbit for the backfield or a gunslinging quarterback. Those were the two things he wanted.
Ernie Piantoso was giving hot takes.
Yes, giving hot takes. He was right there giving those hot takes, and Sam says to him, you know, I've seen a linebacker turn a whole team around before. And Coach completely turns his opinion around as if
he's Tony Maserati.
Right. Yeah, like Maz getting it, hearing from Felger.
You're absolutely right, Sam.
Yeah. And, the Patriots were very much a respectable – what was it? I was talking to our Twitter friend, Michael Parenti, who I've known in real life for since 1997.
And a certified tuna toady.
And he was talking about how terrible the Patriots were for the two decades prior to, the 80s and 90s. And that those two decades are why there were still so many Giants fans in New England. And I said, Mike, I wouldn't be surprised if the Patriots won more games in that time than the Giants did. And in fact, that's what happened. They won.
The Giants were dog shit from the early 60s until the early 80s.
Yes. In the 70s, they were horrific. The commissioner basically had to step in and say, get your act together. And the only reason the win totals are close is because the Giants did get really good under Parcells. They had some really good years. But anyway.
There was just a cult of personality in the fan base, in more specifically the media, with Parcells. That's all it is. He's a polarizing personality. He's a magnetic personality to people just on the surface. Maybe don't take it overly seriously as I do, or people like me.
Do you think that we've done a podcast?
I think this almost resembles a podcast. Yes,
we're getting close. Do we have any like email to look at?
No emails today. How about any listener feedback?
Let's see.
Or ratings.
I don't know. I haven't checked the ratings in a while. Our people are probably mad at us because we haven't done an episode.
Our preparation is second to none, Brown.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
I wouldn't go that far, Tony.
Let's see. I'm trying to find. Where do you get the ratings? It's been so long since I've done
it. Well, I will tell you, Pat Nagawam, friend of the podcast, Pat Nagawam, did email us earlier in the month, and he makes the point about that we made earlier, is that what really torpedoed the Sullivan ownership, and they weren't a great ownership group. They didn't have deep pockets, and they certainly the Michael Jackson, the victory tour, the Sullivans, Chuck Sullivan, Billy's son, went all in on the Michael Jackson victory tour going to then Sullivan Stadium, and the town wouldn't allow it, and they lost all the money in the deposit. And that was really the beginning of the end.
That's correct. All right. Ratings and reviews. This is from Timmy Tough Pants. The headline says, and it's actually from April 6th, so we're catching up on some old reviews here. In addition to Dave's two classic print articles, Dave and Iron Mike are the best and providing real perspective on the news about the Patriots. Let's all stay blessed for our 20-year run with Brady and Belichick together. Okay, this one says, and that was a 5-star review from Curmudgeonland. This is from our friend Ned Snark. Tennis ball head again is the headline. Am I a bad person if I wish the Boston Mediates all get the Wuhan flu? I am. I can live with that.
I wouldn't go that far, Tony.
I don't think either of us endorse that at all. I mean,
maybe, you know, maybe some select members, maybe a dry cough.
Listen, I would like for everyone to just be better. That's it. I don't want anyone.
Don't hold your breath.
There shouldn't be any mortal consequences for not understanding the salary cap. Okay. All right. This one.
If there were mortal consequences for not understanding the salary cap, Ben Volen would be 6 feet under as it is.
So this one says longtime listener, probably says first time reviewer or something, but it's cut off. And it's from April 9th. I already introduced Timmy Tough Pants. He gave us a 5-star review and it says, seems like Dave is moving into the number one seat. Mike Greenberg moving to co-host and Ironhead going to Larry Johnson, third man in seat. Well, Timmy Tough Pants, I don't agree with you. I don't see any room for Mike Greenberg here. I don't think this isn't like WR1, WR2. We don't have numbered positions. This isn't fantasy podcasting, Timmy Tough Pants.
Is he saying I'm a podcaster three behind you and Al? That's what I feel like he's saying.
Mike Greenberg. He's like, Mike Greenberg is going to be like WR2, which I'm not feeling it.
Maybe he can clarify that next time.
But thank you, Timmy Tough Pants, for your review. It really helps people find us. We have been reviewed 110 times now, and we still maintain a 5.0 rating, which is very exciting for us. It's really, we build our whole self-esteem around it. So keep them coming. And it has been tough. It has been tough finding time to do this. I know that your work schedule has become much less, it's just not what it used to be. And the demands of your job have changed. And I know that the demands of my life have changed because I am either providing childcare or doing my job or sleeping. Like those are the three things I do. So it's tough for us to find free time to begin with. And then for us to match up on free time. So, but I'm glad we were able to do it today. I don't know when our next podcast is going to be, but hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we appreciate your patience. Believe me, it's not for lack of wanting to do this. There's a lot of shit that needs to be called out, and I'm glad we have the forum to do it.
We'd still be kind of on schedule if not for our Zoom draft disaster. Because my thinking was that was going to be an episode that we would run it in our podcast feed, and it more devolved into kind of like, well, first there was somebody put, racism. And then
Mike Loico made an appearance early in the podcast, and then it kind of devolved into just a bunch of people who know each other kind of bitching each other and trying to make each other laugh.
Whoever it was that hacked Mike Loico's account hacked our Zoom.
Fair enough.
And then it kind of – so it really started off in this deep valley of chaos. And it turned into a nice conversation among a good group of people as we watched the draft unfold. But it just wasn't like a listenable podcast at the end. So I didn't put it in our
– as if this one is.
Well, I mean, it makes this one look like, like the Joe Rogan
Marconi show. Worthy.
Right. So
I'm looking forward to, now that we've done the Parcells, tried to dispel the Parcells myth. I'm ready. I will call in the work if we can do just all these misnomers and misnotions about the Drew Bledsoe era in New England. Oh God, nothing triggers me more than that guy. Nothing.
See, I'm certainly at a disadvantage there. I was much more in tune with the Parcell stuff than the day-to-day on Bledsoe. So, but I'm willing to hear everything you have to say. I feel like Drew Bledsoe is a very interesting figure in the history of all this. And yeah, it might be worth looking into. So
I'll just say this. I look forward to doing my podcast.
All right. Well, when you're in the number one chair, which
podcast one. Oh, Al, let's be honest. Al is podcaster one.
I mean, for any podcast.
Even ahead of Mike Greenberg.
He's like, you know, like put him in any podcast. He's the number one seat. That's my theory. So, all right. Well, I think we have done a podcast here. I'm very glad we did it. And I look forward to doing it again soon. What are we moving on to? I think we're moving on to.
We're moving on to the unknown.
Yeah, the unknown. We don't know what's going to happen next. So stay tuned. We'll be watching. All right. Thanks for doing this, Mike, and to everybody else. Bye for now.